Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money.
Okay, welcome to our post-midterm election emergency podcast. We're joined by Politico's Nancy Cook and Zach Wormbrot. Thank you both so much for being here after a very long night and a long morning for all of us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
Okay, so we kind of had two waves last night in the midterm elections. We had a blue wave in the House, in the suburbs, in the exurbs that gave Democrats a gain of around 30 seats and control of the House of Representatives. And we had something of a red one in red states that helped Republicans increase their Senate majority. We had a mixed bag in the governorships. Dems picked up Michigan and Illinois and a huge one in Wisconsin. But Republicans held on in Florida and elsewhere, so all around a mixed bag. But the big headline, Democrats retake the House, opening up a new era of potential investigations into Trump and a very changed landscape in Washington. So what does it all mean? Nancy, let's start with you and Trump and the White House reaction. Trump, as expected, is all over the place Tuesday morning on Twitter saying he won big given the Senate results, threatening retribution if Democrats in the House choose to investigate him. But he's also saying that Nancy Pelosi deserves to be House Speaker. So all kinds of messages coming from the president. Nancy, give us the general view of how President Trump is reacting to the midterm elections.
Well, the Trump world is trying to position it as a real win for the White House. They're trying to say that they held on to the Senate, not just held on to it, but picked up a few seats. They're trying to say that, you know, the way that Trump campaigned this last, week and a half of all these rallies and all these different places ultimately was very successful. I think privately there is a recognition that the president does have a problem with women and particularly people in the suburbs. And that's, what we saw out of the House races. But I feel like that's not something that they're going to address immediately. What they're going to do is declare victory and sort of move on. The president is giving a press conference this morning at 11:30, and then he's taking off for Paris on Friday, where he's going to participate in a bunch of military ceremonies with a bunch of world leaders. And that will sort of allow him to pivot and change the subject from these midterm losses and the loss of the House to foreign policy, national security, and that's a place where he can sort of be the commander in chief and sort of show that. And so the White House is not, I would say, totally owning up to some of the losses. And Trump is doing what he often does in these situations, which is sort of projecting his own reality onto this. And in his reality, the White House came out ahead. They're okay. And more importantly, he's eager to move on to the Paris trip, but also just the 2020 campaign. I feel like everyone in the White House is really itching for that.
Yeah, and we should say that our Nancy Cook will be joining the president on his trip to Paris, and a great hardship assignment for her. Zach, going to come to you in a second, but I want to ask you, Nancy, just quickly, beyond the political ramifications and the 2020 ramifications, what are the top line implications for the Trump White House agenda in 2019? Obviously, probably unlikely that he'll get some big new tax cut plan passed, given that Democrats will now control the House, but maybe there's some possibilities on infrastructure. What are the couple of things that the Trump White House thinks it can actually get done in 2019?
Yeah, that's a good question. I talked to a bunch of White House officials and Republicans close to the White House about this over the last week or so. And there's a couple things they want to get done or see if they can get done. I think that there's interest in doing some sort of infrastructure package. And there's a sense that that could potentially be something that, Democrats would latch on to. You know, Chuck Schumer has expressed some interest in that. And so I think that there's going to be an effort to do that. And then also the National Economic Council has really behind the scenes been working on a lot of energy policy, which we haven't heard a ton about so far. And they're going to do that. They're going to start rolling that out over the next few months. And that was something that they were planning both if they, could do something with Congress, but they've also done contingency plans of things that they could do unilaterally through executive actions, orders, regulations. And they really see energy policy as kind of the next frontier of their economic policy development. So they did the tax cuts. Now they want to do energy. And it's everything from making permitting easier to building LNG pipelines to exporting more oil. Basically, it's a more business-friendly energy policy approach. And I think that that's something that your listeners really should watch out for, you know, in the next 4 to 6 months, because that's going to be a huge economic push on the part of the White House.
Interesting. I want to come back and unpack a couple of those details in a second. But Zach, let's talk about Democrats getting the gavels in the House, because that's frankly the biggest headline out of this night and morning. It's huge that Democrats now own levers of power in Trump's Washington, and there's no longer total GOP control. And it's particularly big for the financial services industry and Wall Street, given that we're likely to see Maxine Waters as chair of the powerful House Financial Services Committee. Zach, tell me what it means that we are going to get financial services chair Maxine Waters. Are big bankers totally freaking out about hearings and being dragged to Washington and all the rest of it? What's the big takeaway in the financial services world?
I mean, her rising to the committee chairmanship is just going to be a huge change after, you know, 7 years where you had Republicans who were very focused on, you know, providing, you know, regulatory relief, you know, to the banking industry. It was all about, you know, undoing regulations that were put in place after the crisis. There was very relatively little oversight of the finance industry in terms of investigations from Republicans. And certainly in the last 2 years, there wasn't really in-depth oversight of, you know, what Trump's appointees were doing to roll back some of the rules. And so Waters recently pledged in terms of the banking industry, I'm going to do to you what you did to us, kind of referencing, you know, the foreclosures and some of, you know, the what she calls like toxic products that banks sold that might have damaged the economy. And she's obviously, you know, a top target for Trump. I mean, he's been really vicious to her, calling her a low IQ person. She's called for his impeachment. She was doing that very early. And on the committee, she'll have unilateral subpoena power. And she has said she's going to, or she has at least tried to go after his business dealings through Deutsche Bank. And she's tried to tie that to Russia because Deutsche has been in trouble for some Russian money laundering. She's seeing that it was also a business partner to Trump. And so she will now have the ability to send off subpoenas to Deutsche Bank saying, you know, give me the goods on Trump and, you know, your business dealings with Russia and if there are any ties between the two. And I don't know if Deutsche Bank is going to have much recourse to not provide that. But then if you kind of look deeper at her record on the committee, it's not really all bad for the business community. She actually has a pretty strong track record of working across the aisle with Republicans who, you know, praise her as someone who keeps her word if she does cut a deal with you. You know, under the last several years under Chairman Jeb Hensarling, you know, he's actually clashed a lot with the business community because he is a pretty firm, you know, free market conservative, very ideologically driven, which means that, you know, you want to shut down these big government programs that big businesses depend on, like the Ex-Im Bank. You want to rein in terrorism insurance program. You want to rein in the National Flood Insurance Program. But she's supportive of all those, and she's been able to work with Republicans and like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to keep those going. So, and those are actually must-do items on the committee's agenda. So it's not necessarily all bad for business.
I also think that one thing that, you know, I'll be watching as a White House reporter is what happens with the cabinet members now that the House has oversight, now that Democrats control the House and they have oversight ability. And I feel like particularly for the business sector and the financial sector, you know, there's going to be tremendous pressure on Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin to release Trump's tax returns. There already is a lot of scrutiny of the Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and sort of the role that he played in putting certain sensitive questions on the 2020 census. Trump also sort of has grown tired of Ross and doesn't see him as a killer, as he calls it, or a real negotiator. So I think that we could see a change in the cabinet there. So what I'll be watching as a White House reporter is both, you know, who, which cabinet members do, does the House Oversight Committees, the various ones, drag up to the Hill for hearings? And then two, as these ethical questions come up, sort of which cabinet members end up getting booted by the White House or just deciding that they don't want to deal with it anymore and resigning? Because I think that we're going to see a lot of turnover in the cabinet in the next few months.
Yeah, I mean, that's super interesting and obviously something everybody would be following closely. Like if you had to put a, you know, a top three list for cabinet members who are likely to go, I mean, Ross would seem to be high up there given, you know, Trump's sort of mixed feelings about him and his vulnerability to these hearings and questions about his divestments of assets. And if Democrats decide they really do want to make a good bit of their majority about really digging into some of these allegations of malfeasance against Trump administration cabinet officials, you know, easier if they're just not there. So like who else beyond Wilbur Ross are we talking about in terms of potential departures?
Well, I think Ross is a potential. I think Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is another potential. People in the White House have grown tired of some of the ethical questions that he's had. And you know, Trump, I was told by a Republican close to the White House that Trump does not want a cabinet members with ethical questions heading into 2020. He wants what this person told me is his A team heading into 2020. He doesn't want a scandal filled cabinet. And the other thing that I should point out, which surprised me, is I talked to a Hill staffer this week who said that one expectation for the oversight committees will be to dig a lot into Betsy DeVos. Now, Betsy DeVos is not anyone who the White House wants to push out, but I think Democrats really see her as a prime target of someone to investigate, given what she's done to roll back the rules on lending for student loans and given the what they see as conflicts of interest that she has with that industry. So that's another thing that I feel like will be a real target for House Dems.
Yeah. All right. So, Zach, going back to Waters and financial services for a moment, I spent some of the campaign night just texting and emailing with lobbyists, as I'm sure you did. And, you know, they gave the same review on Waters that, yeah, she works, she can work across the aisle. She worked with Ensslin on the Jobs Act, you know, generally somebody they can get along with. But they're also, you know, super worried that she'll want to score points and have hearings that are embarrassing to the big banks and, you know, exact some revenge, as you talked about. But they also said, look, you know, the game in town in Washington is now with the regulators. Trump has his people in place at the Fed, at the CFTC, the SEC, and, you know, that's where they're really concentrating. And they don't expect much beyond, you know, kind of headline risk from the committee itself. What's your take on that and on how much of the action kind of in the financial space is at the regulators where Trump has his folks in place?
Yeah, I think the industry and the Trump administration have the advantage that when you look at all the top regulatory agencies in the financial services space, I mean, they basically have all the appointees installed who are getting the work done. And, you know, the Senate majority is still going to be there, maybe larger. So, you know, they can still put those people in place, you know, in the next 2 years. But I think that the hope by people who oppose, you know, the Trump deregulatory agenda in this space is that, you know, Waters could shine a light on what they're doing, make it uncomfortable for them, maybe in the case of, you know, the Federal Reserve or some of the banking agencies, make them think twice about, you know, how aggressive they're going to be with deregulation. I mean, I think there's an open question of whether or not someone like Mick Mulvaney, if he's still the acting director of the CFPB, if he's going to respond to that kind of pressure, because he seems to do very well at kind of pushing back on Democrats and, you know, antagonizing them to some extent when he's, you know, answering their questions about these issues. But I mean, we'll see what she uncovers. I mean, it could be something where, you know, if she sees something if she uncovers something one of the regulatory agencies is doing that's so distasteful to even Republicans, maybe they'll think twice about doing it. And I think especially if you're a company like Wells Fargo or Equifax, I mean, even if she's a deal maker on a lot of other issues, you should definitely expect to feel the heat in the near future.
All right, Nancy. So the energy space is really interesting here. And you mentioned building new liquefied natural gas pipelines and the business community should be paying attention to that and Wall Street should be paying attention to that. What are we really specifically talking about here and how much can they accomplish in sort of new energy exploration and all the rest of it that they can do without really caring that House Democrats are now in control?
Yeah, well, I feel like I don't have a great grasp at this point on all of the policy stuff. I feel like the NEC is still developing it. I do know that the director of the NEC, Larry Kudlow, you know, who's a longtime, you know, huge tax person and was very influential in passing the Republican tax bill, even though he was not in the White House at that point, has really spent the last few months focused on this energy stuff. And that is really, I've been told that that is really what people at the NEC have focused on. And so the question for me is how much of this, and this is something that I'm trying to figure out as a reporter, the question is how much of this is like sort of new policy or how much of is this sort of, is them reintroducing ideas that they've had before? Like on permitting, you know, the LNG pipeline stuff, a lot of that is tied to whether or not they can actually get an infrastructure package through those sorts of decisions. And then there's also decisions that would have big foreign policy implications, like, you know, there's a real sense that they want to export more oil and natural gas. And partly that's because they want, you know, to see it as an economic development opportunity. Partly it's so that the U.S. has a bit more energy independence from some foreign countries. And so that's really the targets so far that I see. But, you know, it's interesting because the NEC inside the White House really has been the policy powerhouse of this White House. The Domestic Policy Council has not had that same weight except for immigration, which Stephen Miller runs. And so that is really the place where the smarts are and the people are doing stuff. And so that is a place that I would really watch over, you know, the next few months.
Yeah. And how much do you believe that they can get an infrastructure package that Pelosi and House Democrats would sign on to? And, you know, presumably they would need some Senate Democrats as well, although they'll have an expanded majority. Like, I've always been pretty skeptical that there'll be a kumbaya moment and people join hands. But, you know, Democrats do have an incentive to try to actually govern and do something other than simply investigate Trump and be anti-Trump. I think, you know, one of the messages that a lot of people are taking away from this election is that, you know, simply being resistance is not enough. They have to deliver on things. At the same time, they don't want to give Trump a big win going into 2020. Is there a sense in the White House that, like, yeah, we actually could spend a bunch of money on infrastructure and Democrats will agree to do it?
Well, when I talk to people in the White House over the past week, they've been gaming out different ways to do stuff on infrastructure depending on what the makeup of Congress would be after this election. And so there's a sense of optimism that that would really be a point of compromise for them. And I was actually told, you know, your listeners are wonky enough that they'll find this interesting. I was actually told that, you know, Representative Richard Neal from Massachusetts, who's on the Ways and Means Committee, is so into the idea of infrastructure that he even wants to take the Ways and Means Committee and sort of create like a new little subcommittee just to focus on infrastructure. That's how invested he is. And he is said to have a very good relationship with the White House Legislative Affairs Director, Shahira Knight. You know, they're both tax geeks, so they go back there. But I think that it is sort of a, you know, while the White House expresses optimism about it, I do think that I'm a little pessimistic about it because Democrats and Republicans have such different definitions of what an infrastructure package would look like. So even just like, you know, everyone's like, infrastructure, that sounds great. But to Democrats, that really means pouring a bunch of federal money into sort of public work style projects. For Republicans, that means like, you know, having the private sector sort of take the lead. And so a lot of times they're just talking past each other just on like the top line stuff. And that's not even getting down to the details. And also there's no like plan that exists in a closet in the White House that they can pull out. So they really would have to start from scratch. And I think that's going to be hard, too, in this divided environment.
So, Nancy, one of the big fights in the next Congress will probably be about whether Democrats can get the long awaited Trump tax returns, you know, whether if they do, there's anything, you know, terribly shocking in there. And this could come down to a power fight with Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary. Obviously, Treasury runs the IRS, the home of all tax returns. Like, what's Mnuchin going to do here?
Well, Mnuchin is a very careful person. And, you know, in an interview with the New York Times, the New York Times wrote about the idea that the Democrats are going to go after Trump's tax returns. He was very careful and sort of said, well, you know, we'll follow the process, but we have to see what happens with the election. But, you know, just internally in the White House, he is one of the president's most trusted and most loyal advisors. And he really goes out on a limb to show his loyalty time and time again, way outside of the economic portfolio. I mean, when Trump sort of raises these culture wars about NFL players kneeling, Mnuchin comes out with a statement, which seems strange from the Treasury Secretary to do, sort of supporting Trump. And so just from a relationship perspective, given the status that he enjoys with the president, the loyalty that he's demonstrated, and the fact that he appears to really like his job as Treasury Secretary, I am so hard-pressed to see him cooperating in any way with the House Democrats to turn over the tax returns. I feel like he's gotten this far by demonstrating tremendous loyalty to the president and sort of being by the president's side. You know, he was at the White House last night. He was among a small group of family members, top aides, watching the returns with the president. He goes to Mar-a-Lago with the president. You know, he worked on the campaign. I just can't see him in any way turning over the tax returns unless he is completely compelled by, you know, some sort of court decision. It's just not in his nature or in the way he interacts with Trump or the government.
All right. So, Zach, we're recording this right after the opening bell on Wall Street on Wednesday. It seems like investors are pretty happy with the results of this election, the Dow opening up 230 some points. Of course, you know, who knows where it winds up the day, but the initial reaction is positive, I think, you know, partly because it's exactly what people expected, which was Democrats take the House, Republicans hold the Senate. We've got divided government and gridlock, and that's not really bad for markets, particularly since they've already got their tax cuts and deregulation. And I'm looking at bank stocks. The KBW NASDAQ Bank Index is rising this morning, presumably because people are not freaking out about Maxine Waters and the House Financial Services Committee chair that she is about to take over. Does that reaction surprise you at all that bank stocks would, you know, kind of tick up a little bit on this one?
No, I think, like you mentioned earlier, I think, you know, bank lobbyists in town know who they're working with. I mean, I think they know there's going to be bad headlines for certain companies, especially Wells Fargo. But I don't think that the house flipping poses any existential threat to these larger banks. I mean, and some of them are coming off a really big win earlier this year where they got deregulation, you know, from Congress that they had been seeking for years. So a lot of those banks have kind of gotten what they wanted, and they know the real game is at the regulatory agencies, which, you know, thanks to the Senate staying in GOP control, I mean, that those agencies will continue to be manned by Trump appointees.
Yeah, and they also know, investors clearly know, that efforts to break up the big banks are not really going to go anywhere. And I think you made a great point earlier, which is Jeb Hensarling, the former House Financial Services Chair, outgoing chair, was very ideological. And a lot of people worried about, you know, whether he might be kind of maybe pro break up the big banks. But really, there's no chance of that happening, right?
No, I think one thing that when I talk to bank lobbyists, what they do worry about is they do know that the break up the banks talk will only pick up as we get closer to the 2020 election. I mean, they're looking at the field of Democrats who are likely to run. I mean, Warren and Sanders are front runners. They're very far. They've kind of staked their, you know, political profiles on attacking Wall Street and breaking up the banks. And you're seeing kind of one after another, you know, like Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris. I mean, they're all finding ways to take digs at the banks. So, you know, when I talk to bank industry folks in town, they actually seem a little bit more concerned about the 2020 race than what Maxine Waters will do, because they know what they're going to get.
Got it. So, Nancy, we'll leave it with Trump looking at the stock market reaction this morning. I don't know if he's tweeted about it yet. He probably has, and we'll wait until a little bit later in the day. But boy, he loves it when stocks go up. Barometer for his administration. Mnuchin early on in this administration said, you know, stock prices are a report card on how we've done. Had a rough go of it in October with markets selling off a lot for a number of reasons, but they're rising today. How do you think Trump is going to react to Wall Street reacting to the election?
Well, I think Trump has always viewed the stock market, as you said, as another form of polling. And so I think that he's going to see the stock market being up at the opening bell as another data point that he can use to show that this election was a success for him, that, you know, the markets are pleased, the economy's, you know, doing great. And I think that he'll take it as another validator. And that's something that we'll be watching for when Trump talks today.
Yeah, and it will be fun, and everybody will be watching. Nancy Cook, thank you so much for joining us after a long night. Zach Warmbrot, also thank you to you, master of all things banking and financial services. And here's to a really interesting couple of years coming up in Congress. And the 2020 election just started, but we're going to wait on that for a little while. Thank you to you both. Great stuff.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
That's a wrap for this week's Politico Money. Thanks to my producer, Jenny Ament. And our executive producer is Dave Shaw. If you're liking the show, please do subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Rate us and write a written review. We'll be back with you next week.